You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hi, welcome everybody, wherever you are around the world, listening to my show here on the couch. This is your friendly psychologist, Dr. Michelle Cohen, and I have an amazing guest today who has written a most fascinating book. And let's just jump into it. His name is Dr. Paul Weinberg. He's, of course, an MD. His latest book is called ER Doctor, Tales of an Emergency Room Doctor. All right, everybody, this is a page turner. I could not put this one down because it really gives you a full understanding of what Dr. Weinberg has done, how he's experienced so many different situations, has been flexible, saved so many lives, and of course has actually experienced PTSD at some time in his own life because of situations, you know, working with all of these individuals, emergencies, unexpected surprises in the ER and beyond in other countries. So we're going to be bringing him up right now live. Dr. Weinberg, thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
Wow. I got to tell you, your book is wonderful. The Unpredictable Life of an ER Doctor at the Frontline of Medicine. Oh, my goodness. I think you brilliantly explain to people your journeys and all of the different situations that you have had to deal with in your life. And I'm sitting here reading through your book and my mouth was, oh, my gosh, my mouth was open going, what? What a journey. So these tales of an emergency room doctor are wonderful. So if you can hear me, Dr. Weinberg, I'm just, why was it that you decided to write this book?
This book needed to be written, and yes. I was glad that I had a chance to do it. There are about over 150 million emergency department visits a year in the United States.
Oh my goodness!
Everyone's been to the emergency department, and this was a glimpse, a confession, behind the scenes of what's going on with the physicians who are giving care there.
Sure.
Also, I needed to do it to sort of get some of my feelings and some of my stress out. I wanted to get these stories onto paper and get them out of my head. And I wanted to a little bit create a legacy for my daughters who are now grown so they could see the work that their dad did for a lifetime.
Yes. And that's lovely. You do talk about your kids actually in the book, and we'll get to that just a little bit as well. But just to give listeners right now an idea, Dr. Paul Weinberg has spent 30 years. You have been a medical doctor in the emergency room at a busy megalopolis hospital, and you've seen everything. Absolutely everything, you name it. And learning the intricacies of medicine and surgery opened up many opportunities for Dr. Weinberg to interact with the lives of very broad range of people. And you describe this as a strange career. Entry into the field allowing all who are brave or foolish enough to venture into the river without the knowledge of the rapids and the waterfalls ahead. So my question to you is, why did you become an ER doctor?
I became an emergency room doctor in a surprising way. When I first entered medical school, I thought I was going to be an internist, a learned, kind of elegant internist, making subtle and important diagnoses. But I found that wasn't where my heart was. And as I went through surgery and I went through the emergency department, the intensity of action and the chance to promptly, as compared to internal medicine, promptly make a difference in someone's life, captured my medical spirit.
And yes.
I became an emergency medicine physician.
My gosh. And I was also reading that, you know, you were drawn in the late 70s until 2006 to working at a very busy trauma center in Orange County. I know where you were. I live here in Southern California. And it was a full service medical center. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that? There was OB, neonatal, oncology. I mean, you guys handled everything, right?
Yes.
Oh my God.
This was an excellent practice because you had the fullest range of complications, not only the ordinary or not so ordinary trauma from freeway wrecks, but
right.
you had gang activity.
Yes.
You had high risk OB issues. Oof. You had critically ill children. You had a cardiac transplant, so you saw the complications of cardiac surgery.
Yeah.
It was excellent. It was an excellent practice. And the hospital was small enough, nimble enough, and you got to know all the other physicians on the staff. So if you needed help, which
yes.
you often did, in managing a you know, kind of a desperate case, you could call them up and they would be there promptly rather than giving you any kind of runaround. It was good. It felt like a team, and working with a team like that was a good experience.
Oh, that's beautiful, and how nice. And you all have to know everything. I mean, that's what fascinates me, is everything about oncology, cardiac surgery, you name it, pediatrics. I mean, what an intensive education, not only in practice and live, but, you know, in your medical training as well. So, I mean, that...
Well, it's, you know, that, Michelle, that's flattering to say that you know everything. But what you do need to know is the first, the first five moves in most specialties.
Yes.
Not everything, but you have to know what to do until the dust settles, till the smoke clears a little bit.
Yes.
And that that's a very broad practice.
Oh, I bet. You know, and as most of, I'm sure, your interviews, some of these popular emergency room TV shows depict perhaps those first five steps that, you know, doctors perform when people are coming into the, you know, they're rolling them in, the paramedics, and they say, you know, the paramedics are discussing what's going on. And is that what you're talking about? Some of the first five steps is, are those true?
Yes. Exactly right. You know, you need to promptly make a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need promptly to initiate treatment. Oftentimes you're doing it simultaneously.
Mm.
And until things are clear, you have to continue going forward to stabilize the patient.
Oh, my God.
And you don't know where they're going to take you because the subtleties of diagnosis may not be there yet.
Right. And you have to keep looking. And you're like a detective, actually. Yeah, you know. Trying to find the cause of what's going on.
Yeah, you are like a detective, you know, and you know, to look with your eyes and to try to pick up all the clues.
Yes.
And to talk to the patient if they are still able to give a history is the essence of the quick diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. You know, in your book, you were talking about how, you know, Friday for most people is an easing of work and the beginning of rest. But in the ER, you said it's a time of stress and chaos that usually begins shortly after noon. So can you paint a picture and describe some of your most intense and chaotic Fridays, you know, weekend days of patient surprises in the ER? I found that chapter fascinating.
Well, what happens on Friday is the physicians start to shut down their offices. So anything they might have ordinarily taken care of,
mm-hmm.
they refer to the emergency department. People are starting their weekend, so
right.
that's, they want to get out of town. They want to party with yeah. all the risks attendant to alcohol or drug use. And the defenses of people are let down, and the background of chaos and disorder increases, and they get swept into the emergency department. And that's where the intensity begins. And it can begin with, say a parental neglect of a child because they're doing something else, mm-hmm. and an ordinary pneumonia turns into something much more severe, mm-hmm. or an obvious accident that didn't need to happen, but because you were trying to get out to the desert or something, you were drinking heavily and had a big automobile accident. And then just the release from work and the freedom that people have allow them to act less responsibly. And that's where all that stuff is coming from.
Oh, my goodness. So, we've all had to deal with COVID for the last 2 years plus. And I have a girlfriend who's actually an ER nurse in one of the pretty well-known hospitals here in the Valley. And she had to, after a year and a half of, actually living in the ER, she has her own bed and her own little room because of the nature of what she does. And she's done it for, 20 years. So she knows what to do. And a lot of the doctors rely on her because she's such a pro. She actually had to go on medical leave because she was so stressed out from the chaos of the COVID. Did you see this in many situations? And what was that like, being on the floor and dealing with the chaos?
Well, it's the continual stress of a medical practice. Yeah. Where you're taking care of extremely ill people, and if it's an infectious disease like COVID, where you can become ill, makes the emergency department practice a bit like a warlike setting.
Right.
You're trying to get through and do what you need to do, your duty, your mission. And the patients, because they could infect you, it's the equivalent of being shot at.
It's right. So
highly, highly stressful. And the waves of patients just kept coming and coming and coming.
Oh my gosh.
It was severe. It was severe.
Yes.
The patient is then under great stress, and I think they're probably still suffering from it, even though the numbers have gone down.
Sure. I mean, it's still alive and well. And,
it's still alive and well. Yes, it is.
Our medical experts are reminding us that you've got to still, be careful and cautious. I still wear a mask. I'm one of those rare people here in Los Angeles that will go out to, whatever I have to do in public, and I'll wear a mask. We're still doing that at our medical doctor's offices, which is good. You feel good about that.
Yeah, that's where people are concentrated. But if I go to a supermarket or some place where the number of people seems too high for the air volume or the air turnover,
sure,
I put my mask on, and I use the N95 mask.
Oh, that's great. That's the way to go. I'll tell you, those are the best. A part of your book I was fascinated with are many of the patients who like to come into the ER between, say, maybe 2 and 3 or 4 a.m. And I know that, oh my God, I know that there are many, as we call them, night crawlers throughout your years of work. Can you share with us some of those experiences or common types of patients and situations that come to mind?
The way they have, there are many populations of people, but there are certainly owls and larks.
Yes.
And the owls who are roaming around at 2, 3, 4 in the morning are generally a different group of people than the larks, the day people.
Yes.
And they are, broadly speaking, are quite uncommon, a little less usual.
Right.
They are they inhabit the darkness comfortably.
Right.
That's the way to say it.
Yeah.
And they bring with them, issues of substance abuse, neglect, psychiatric illness that you don't see often on the day shift.
Sure.
And then you have just things are always a bit worse at night.
Sure.
You know, the shortness of breath is severe. The wound is bigger and longer and deeper.
Sure.
There's more neglect. The infections are overtaking the people.
Oh, my goodness.
It really represents darkness.
Sure. And, you're trying to figure out, who's going to have to have Narcon, on the IV or whatever shot or whatever that is, who come in and are dealing with issues like that. That's a whole other ball of wax, because you're having a lot of people who overdose and there's nothing you can do about it. You do the best you all can, but yeah, it must be really traumatic to try to deal with that.
It's, the folks who come in at night are hurting more than the day folks.
Sure. Yeah.
And the day people who get caught up at a nighttime event, they're hurting a lot also.
Right.
It's a hard time. It's a hard time for all. And the staff, fortunately, is usually acclimatized to work in the night shift, so they're fully alert and active. But the people who live in the daytime who have a nighttime problem, they're so messed up they can hardly give a history sometimes.
Right.
It's tough for them.
Sure is. I bet it has. I also appreciated in your book where you talk about how your children did well during their worrisome developmental years when, many of our teens experiment with drugs and other substances. You kind of explain why your teens did so well. Can you share with the listeners some of the things you told?
Well, they heard unfortunate. They heard stories, most of them unfortunate, about how substance abuse can mess you up.
Sure.
And they would hear the stories, and I would tell them with a bit of exaggeration. Nothing good happens after midnight. And then I'd say with a smile, let's make that 10 a.m. Let's make that 10 p.m.
Right.
And I think they finally got it.
Yes, exactly. And that's in a way, you don't want to scare them too much, but you just want to let them know some of the really sad and horrific emergencies that you had to deal with people who, had some substance abuse issues and, that leads to all these other troublesome situations. So, that was good for them to understand and know that firsthand from you.
That's right. Yeah. That's absolutely right. Fortunately, at that time we were living in Central California. I was still working in Orange County. So the temptation of some of those things was reduced.
Yes.
That was also why they did, I think, as well as they did.
Oh, that's true. That's real. I understand that. You explain in your book, you say, quote, the things that you've seen during your time in the trauma center have remained in your mind for many years, and how they have begun to open your eyes to events such as mass shootings, bombings, riots, and crowd-rushed injuries. How did all those things change you into a different person?
It has changed me. I think I avoid high-density events with a lot of people around.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of invisible in public. You wouldn't recognize me. I try to detour around things that I think are going to be a problem or severe.
Yes.
I know how easy it is to lose what you have with random interactions with folks who are disturbed or violent. And it's, in that sense, it's made me, a kinder, gentler.
Right. Sure. Absolutely. You know.
Mm-hmm. And I think also seeing these things over years has given me a little bit of background and certainly manageable PTSD.
Yeah.
You know, because my imagination can match my reality.
Yeah.
So you know what can be going on.
Yes. Yeah, that's for sure. I'll tell you. By the way, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with your friendly psychologist, Dr. Michelle here, and my special guest, Paul Weinberg, medical doctor. He's written an amazing book. It's called ER Doctor, Tales of an Emergency Room Doctor. If you want to know really what goes on in an emergency room and all of the things that these emergency room medical doctors have to know and have to do and get surprised with, this is the book. It's such a page turner, Dr. Weinberg. After I finished the book, I was thinking to myself, and there's probably so much more that he could have crammed into this nice, comfortable read that was intriguing about all of the traumas and situations that you've had to deal with. And not to mention, of course, all of the patients and their fears and the difficulty, you know, with their mental issues and stuff. So thank you so much for writing this book. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. There's another group of people who you describe as revolving regulars. I actually, in my practice as a psychologist, I work with several of those people, and you know, there's psychosomatic issues going on. In my case, they're usually somatoform disorders or something like that. But in your case, I mean, some of these regulars are really facing serious issues that can't be worked with by a mental health professional. Can you talk a little bit more about the revolving regulars, as you call them?
Yes, the revolving regulars, sometimes they had psychiatric problems, sometimes they had chronic medical problems, and of course, if you have a chronic medical problem, you wound up having psychiatric problems related to that in many cases. One of the fortunate things about an emergency practice is that there's no barrier to entry. If you have a problem, you just show up and you will be seen. So there is no copay. There's no cash up front. You just show up and you are seen and stabilized. And that's in a certain way, that's absolutely great. And I really like that part of the practice.
Oh, yeah.
There are folks out there who, for example, have asthma. And a variety of reasons, they run out of their medications, or they're not taking them properly, or something sets them off. And they would be brought in, sometimes mild, sometimes very severe, with shortness of breath. And you would, over months or even sometimes years, you would get to know them, and you'd become like a primary care physician, and it would take care of them and give them prescription refills.
Yes, yes.
There was another asthmatic patient who had a crippling asthma.
Right.
Every time I would see him, he would be desperately, desperately short of breath, and I would have to do an emergency procedure on him, put a tube into his trachea to breathe for him. And I saw this poor man many times, and really just and saved him, and saved him. And that was good. Other folks have, you used the word a somatoform disorder.
Yes.
And they would come in for chronic chest pain. They would come in for abdominal pain. No one else had made a diagnosis on them. No one else could make a diagnosis on them.
Sure.
And you would see them, begin to evaluate them again and try to make a diagnosis, stabilize them, and give them an additional a time of comfort until they could see someone else.
Wow. Yeah.
So you had a small group of regulars.
Sure. Group of regulars, you know, and no, it was fascinating. You were speaking about the particular gentleman who had asthma. You have in one of your chapters, all that wheezes is not asthma. So there are a lot of other, you know, complications that are going on besides, oh, I'm allergic or I have asthma, you know, popping up. Nope. There's a lot deeper issues going on sometimes for people. And you are the doctor who discovered many of those issues. So kudos to you on that particular, you know, issue.
The press is always filled with misdiagnoses by physicians.
Right.
Or physicians who don't take patients' complaints seriously, and it turns out to be something treatable.
Sure.
Well, in my practice, I would take all these complaints very seriously.
Sure.
And collect enough information to validate or non-validate that complaint.
Right.
And that for me was very important, because you were really looking rather than not looking. And that made a difference in the ability to make diagnoses.
Boy, here's an
example that comes to mind.
Yeah.
I was working in a small rural emergency department in Northern California.
Uh-huh.
And here was this young man in his about late 20s who was kind of known to the nursing staff, and he was kind of a hateful kind of person.
Yeah.
And the staff really didn't like him. And before I saw him, they were trying to prejudice me against him, which I recognized and ignored.
Sure, sure.
And he came in with his usual kind of complaint of falling down or something like that. And I had the time and the effort, and I carefully examined him. I carefully examined him, ignoring the quick write-off that the nursing staff wanted me to do. And it turned out he had something going on with his brain. He needs to be referred to a bigger hospital. Imaging studies of the brain showed an operative lesion, and he was sent off to San Francisco, where they operated on him.
Wow.
So you know, be careful, be thorough, do a good job, and you'll avoid those kind of errors.
Oh, you my know, goodness.
Don't be swayed.
Yeah.
Don't be swayed by prejudgment. Collect your own data and act on it.
Well, that's, you know, brilliant advice for other ER doctors, those who are, you know, especially those who are starting out, and, you know, of course, to your colleagues who've been there and done that. I mean, it must be difficult, though, for, you know, it's interesting to me from a psychological point of view. You first of all talked about the press and how they get a lot of, you know, people complaining or this and that. Well, it, you know, from the patient's shocked brain, you know, when they come in, or the fearful brain or whatever, they're coming from a me place. But you all as emergency room doctors are coming to assess what's going on immediately. You don't have time to put on this wonderful, friendly, you know, continuous psychologist hat of having this beautiful bedside man. And how are you? Let us talk. You know, you guys are on it. You have to get down to business and work. So I think there's sometimes, you know, there's such a misunderstanding because people are so desperate and they're scared, and their families or whoever brings them in, they're on you guys as well. So it must be so difficult to manage, you know, to try to manage their, you know, emotional states as well as focus on what the real trauma is or the problem is that's going on. So how have you sort of tutored your colleagues?
You know, in one extreme, you do excuse me. In one extreme, you do your best work on in emergency medicine on unconscious people. Okay, so your bedside manner doesn't matter so much. Just what you do it. On the other hand, you learn through experience how to present in a way that makes the patient most comfortable.
Right.
And that's really important. And patients sort of figure out what's how you are and your attitude to them in just a few minutes. You know, they are very sensitive to everything you do. And if you can make a good appearance to them and make them feel comfortable, they can start to tell you accurately what's going on.
Yeah.
And then you learn to talk to the patient and the other people in the room with them to get a fuller picture. But
yes,
the amount of time that you spend with them is usually not as much as you'd like to. There's quite a time stress, particularly in an urban practice where the emergency departments are so busy. In
sure.
the rural areas, you could spend
right.
much more time there and talk with the folks and get a better feel of what's going on with them.
Yes. No, that's beautiful because of your experience. So yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah. Last night I was watching one of those ER shows where the medical director told one of his residents who had to tell the patient that she was dying. The medical director said to this resident, you know, don't be so nice. Stop acting like a social worker, be a doctor and tell her without the flowery words, what is going on? And he was really angry because this little sweet little resident, this female doctor was like, I did sort of tell them, but I have a different way of expressing my, he said, just straight away, lay it on there. Tell them.
God. I think that makes for good TV or
there
movies for bad medical practice.
There you go. Exactly. I thought, now that's strange. Why is he getting mad at her for being able to be, you know, gracious and have the right words in order to express what's going on, you know? So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Something else that goes on all over the world, all over the country, but having spent many of your 30 years, as I have, in this densely urban area of Southern California, everybody who lives here knows about the Southern California freeways. I mean, it's a joke, you know, to everyone else who doesn't live here. I have many relatives who have moved out of town, moved out of state, and even out of country to get away from Southern California. Car accidents must be a huge cause or a large percentage of the ER patients' issues, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
You know, most automobile accidents are minor.
Yes, they are minor.
Cars are so well designed. Most people wear seat belts, so the severity isn't so great. But yes, there are horrendous automobile accidents, usually after hours when you can have high speed on the freeways, and usually drugs or alcohol, both are involved. And there have been, too many sad cases of greatly severe injuries that you had to take care of. These are the folks who were brought to a trauma center. It's called an accident, but maybe it's really not an accident, or it's very preventable.
Yes.
And where lives can be saved by prompt care and surgical intervention.
Yes. It's, I mean, it's, I hear these stories from people who are suffering from PTSD from, you know, traumatic car accidents and, you know, what they have done and how someone came out of the blue or changed lanes quickly in Southern California here on one of the crazy freeways. I mean, just, you know, really scary stories. And I appreciate how in your book, ER Doctor, Tales of an Emergency Room Doctor, that you discuss some of these issues with car accidents and you have takeaways to drivers. What are some of those biggest takeaways you tell to drivers all over the country and to be aware of?
Yeah. If you, you know, wear your seatbelt.
Yes.
Don't drive too fast. don't drink and drive. Don't do drugs and drive.
Right.
If you're really starting to worry about it, empty your bladder before you get into a
wreck
and you don't rupture your bladder.
That's right. Right.
Don't drive aggressively. Don't get into a road rage situation.
Yeah, and I think is that well said, Dr. Weinberg? Because that's the biggest thing that I'm seeing, especially around the COVID era, as I call it right now. People they feel pent up. They feel that they've been trapped because they haven't been able to socialize that much or go to work or do what they want to do on a regular basis. So they're so pent up, and they're angry drivers out here. Very scary. It's a thing too. It's the road rage, as you mentioned, and then people do really dangerous things. So,
and in many cases, the folks who, they may be more violent and more unstable than you are, or they may have less to lose than you do. And one of the states has a slogan. I think it might be Texas.
Yeah.
Drive friendly, and that's good advice.
Yes, that's right. I mean, driving friendly. That's exactly right. You know, and don't if someone tries to be aggressive to you, just let them go, because chances are in the world of driving, they're going to unfortunately hurt someone else or get themselves into an accident because they're erratic and they have rage issues, or like you said, they're on substances. You know, where they can't. You just have to, keep your eyes open and be careful.
I agree. You know, in that sense, it'd be interesting to see when there's finally self-driving cars, if road rage is diminished.
Right, exactly. I was really fascinated also by by your chapter where you talk about working in the LACUSCMC hospital jail ward. Now, that was fascinating when I read about some of the personality styles of the inmates towards you and how you overcame some of that. What did you observe in these inmates?
I don't have a great deal of experience with the criminal side of the population, but it was eye-opening to work at the jail ward at the Big County Hospital in East L.A.
Yeah.
You would be the first physician to see these people brought in by the different law enforcement authorities.
Sure.
And these poor people they were so, their distress level was so high. They had just been arrested, and they may or may not have had medical problems. They were very, very messed up.
Yeah.
And often it was drugs and alcohol, psychiatric problems, handcuffed. You had to figure out what was going on with them. They could.
Right.
Or could, most of the time they couldn't give you a good history, or they'd be a little afraid to give you a history, a real history, because they didn't have sufficient privacy from law enforcement.
Yes.
It was a challenging post.
Oh, I bet. Very, very interesting. And you have to do what you do best and deal with a lot of personalities who are trying to sort of manipulate you as well into charming the doctor. And
Heavy duty manipulation by the women.
Yes.
You know, with elements of seduction.
Sure.
And heavy duty manipulation by the men with just how their personality was.
Sure.
You know, they wouldn't tell you the truth. Right. And you had to figure out what the truth was.
Yeah. How did you get this injury that you had to report usually if it was a shot?
Or as my friend shot me, something like that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I loved your chapter called I Loved Being a Hero. So can you share with us some of the wins that you've kept in your heart, some of the most positive situations where the outcomes were wonderful because of you?
Well, you know, I think one of the most fun things for me as an emergency medicine doctor, where you feel like a hero, is given sugar to someone in a diabetic coma and they wake up.
Right.
That feels great.
Yes.
Other things that feels great for me also is taking a foreign body out of someone.
Oh, yeah, sure.
A grain of sand in an eye or a fish hook in a hand.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Anywhere, or a foreign body anywhere in the body. That was very rewarding.
Sure.
I always found putting a joint that came out, a dislocation, back into place. That was another very rewarding cases for me. It wasn't because you made the intervention and you could promptly see the result, and so could the patient. So that was mutual admiration then.
Yes, yes, I love those stories. It's so wonderful. Yes,
and they did make me. And you know, even though they were, many of them were simple and made me feel good, or that were technically complicated, they made you feel good, and that was a good thing. You know, another cases that I always liked was treating people with asthma that wasn't terribly severe, but just mild enough that they felt uncomfortable, and giving them medicine where they could promptly breathe again within just a few minutes. Good cases.
Absolutely. And those are the things where people feel like they're, I don't know, they're so scared and they come in and what am I doing? And I might, you know, die and this kind of thing. But these are doable issues that you can deal with and, you know, get them in and out, or even one night, have them spend the night in the hospital, and then they're fixed, or they're better, or they're done. They're on the meds. They, you know, you put the dislocation back into the right place, remove the fish hooks or whatever. And here you go. Here's your antibiotics. You're good to go. You're sutured. And that feels so good because people are so grateful, aren't they? People are just, oh my gosh, for the most part, I would say.
Yes. Those were the most thankful patients because it wasn't overwhelming. Their problem wasn't so overwhelming that they were looking into the void of death, and they had prompt improvement that everyone could see and or agree on that they were doing better. Those are good cases. Stopping nosebleeds are in the same category.
Yes, exactly. That's another one. And people don't know. I mean, that's scary. That's very scary.
That's very, very scary for people. Very, very scary. And, you know, the messiness of it disturbs them as well.
Yes, yes. Do you see or have you seen more cases of cancer in your experiences? Or is it just that we never really knew as much about it and we have more ways of examining, figuring out if there's a tumor or whatever's going on? Or are the cases getting more just defined in the population? Are there a lot more?
You know, as an emergency, it's getting easier to diagnose cancer, period.
Good.
So, you know, the imaging studies and blood studies are there that allow a diagnosis to be made easier.
Yes.
In my practice, the more underserved the community, the more I would make a diagnosis of cancer in the emergency department.
Yes. Yes.
In other words, the neglect, the failure to get primary care. Mm-hmm. These folks had come in with symptoms that, had they seen someone some months earlier, the diagnosis might have been made then. But for so many reasons, it wasn't. And I would see them and make that unfortunate diagnosis.
Well, it's good to know that it's a lot easier to diagnose these days. And like you said, early treatment leads to recovery, usually.
Yes.
In many cases.
Usually that's right.
Yeah.
You know, earlier is definitely better in regarding that.
Sure. Sure. You share that in a, you talk about some of the lessons you've learned, which is terrific in your book, that you can always add but cannot take away giving medicines. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you give someone a dose of medication that's too much for their system, how do you get it out? Well, it's right. Very, very difficult. Most of the time, the body will metabolize it, or in a severe case, you hemodialyze them, or peritoneal dialyze them, or perhaps give them a reversing agent. So it's much safer to give them a small amount, see the result, and then add to it. And add to it multiple times until you get the desired effect.
Sure, exactly. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, my goodness. Yeah. You don't know about that.
Yeah, and that's a lesson. And that's a lesson I think all doctors learn in their practice really early on. That I gave this person a little too much of something, and they had some side effects. Next time, I'll start with a smaller amount and move up to the higher dose.
Sure, exactly. That makes a lot of sense. So for people in general, I mean, people who come in with not accidents per se, car accidents or stabbings or bombings or, you know, some of the horrific accidents, victims of accidents that you've had to work on and help. In terms of, getting checkups, getting, early diagnoses, what kind of advice would you give to people out there who, maybe coming into the ER a little too late? What would you give to them to prevent issues in general?
Well, I like that question. That's an excellent question. You want to increase your health span.
Yes.
And the big thing that you can do to increase your health span generally is, broadly speaking, is exercise and diet.
Yes.
You know, leading a healthy lifestyle, as boring as that is and as interesting as it is.
Right.
Don't abuse your body nor your mind. And that, with ordinary genetics, will, add multiple years to your life.
Right.
And then I think pay enough attention to your body and that if you start to feel something isn't right, get it checked out. Men in general should listen to the women in their life, because the men are filled with denial.
Sure.
You know, they'll deny things until they're really hurting. And if the woman in life says, go see the doctor, try not to fight it and just go.
Boy, that is well said.
Do basic things. Get your blood pressure. Get your blood pressure checked. Get your blood sugar checked. Make sure your weight is close to ideal.
Perfect.
Eat well, not too much. And try to build into your life some physical activity. Our modern lives are, from my point of view, way too sedentary. Everyone's just sitting around.
Boy, is that true.
Clearly, don't smoke too much, don't drink too much, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, there you go. We'll see what happens. Try to do the best you can, yeah.
And this is, to me, this is not controversial, but people will think it's controversial, is vaccinations. I think you should get vaccinated. Almost every vaccine out there is a health bargain.
Yes. There's so many controversial things that people come up with about, the mRNA technology, et cetera, that kind of thing. But you're saying, as a specialist, as a renowned ER and other type of doctor who's worked around the world, you're saying, got to get the shots, because these are helping people and curing people and keeping people from getting the severe forms of COVID, right?
Well, COVID and many other infectious diseases.
Everything.
COVID. you know, broadly speaking, almost any vaccine is on a cost-benefit analysis or is very, very worth it.
Right. Exactly. Beautiful. I think that's a wonderful sort of note to end on. And people, if you want an amazing book that will give you an understanding of Dr. Weinberg's over 30 years of being an ER doctor and working around the world and in different situations, trauma centers, private practice, primarily though in ER situations, this book will have you rethinking about how you understand healthcare and the ER. So thank you so much, Dr. Paul Weinberg, for bringing this book to us. It's been a delight talking with you here, and carry on helping people out, and bless you again for all the work that you do.
This was a delightful interview, Dr. Michelle. I really enjoyed talking with you. We had some good dialogue and some excellent questions.
Wow.
I appreciate recommending the book. Folks can reach me at erdoctips.com. Great. If they want additional information or are curious about me a little bit more.
Perfect. That's great.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Dr. Paul Weinberg again. The book is called ER Doctor, Tales of an Emergency Room Doctor. All right. Thank you again.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Michelle Cohen. I thank you for being on the couch here, and we'll be back next week with another terrific guest to help you elevate your consciousness and become mentally healthier. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.